Welcome back.
Welcome back to episode 42.
Killer Bays Podcast.
Season 3, baby.
Thanks for tuning in, as always.
Yes, yes.
There's not really any updates this week.
No, we can probably jump into it. Hope everyone's staying warm.
Yes, had to turn the heat on.
Given that it has snowed in October.
Yes.
Quite depressing, but hey. We're all from New England around here. And if not, you're not actually, then you are in spirit. So,
yeah.
You understand our pain.
Exactly.
We're used to it. We're getting by.
I'm not used to it.
No, I'm not actually prepared at all. I was just telling Kirby that I forgot my snow scraper. And I was not expecting it to snow in October. Although, also, I just forgot. I'm just dumb. But so I had to try to use my Swiffer to clean off my car and it didn't work and people were looking at me and it was embarrassing.
I wish I'd seen it.
Yeah, I just had to wait for the sun to melt the snow, which it did. So, because, you know, it was like 50 something today here. The day after it was like 30. So.
That's crazy.
Well, that was all. So let's just jump in because we do have a good case this week. Last week we gave you some spooks. This week we're going to also give you some spooks, but these are true crime spooks, I guess.
Yeah, different spooks.
Different kind of spooks. They're very different. This week, we are covering another serial killer from New England. His name is Israel Keyes, as you've probably guessed from the title. We've talked about the Boston Strangler in episode 8, all the way back in little season 1. But this time around, we're going to the state of Vermont. According to Insider.com's article, "The Most Notorious Serial Killer from Each State," Israel Keyes is Vermont's most notorious serial killer. We should probably know right from the start that Keyes was not confined to Vermont, not hardly. In fact, it is believed that most of his victims were killed outside of Vermont, and Keyes traveled all over the country continuously. But he did manage to cause quite the stir in the otherwise fairly quiet state of Vermont in 2011, when he murdered Bill and Lorraine Currier of Essex, Vermont. All right, so let's jump right into some background info on Keyes and his upbringing. Most of this information is from a website called Criminal Minds Wiki. So Israel Keyes was born on January 7th, 1978 in Richmond, Utah, to John Jeffrey Keyes and Heidi Hackinson. Keyes was far from an only child. He was the second child of 10 children born, in fact. He had an older sister, 4 younger sisters, and 3 younger brothers. His parents didn't believe in government interference, public schools, or modern medicine. That sounds pretty familiar in this day and age as well. They lived an isolated existence in the woods where Keyes grew up without heat or electricity. We even heard that he grew up in a tent while his father was making his house. When he was a toddler, the Keyses moved to Washington State in an area where the majority were considered a Mormon environment. The Keyes kids were homeschooled there, but they did occasionally attend a Christian identity church in the area. So Christian identity is a known racist, anti-Semitic, and white supremacist interpretation of Christianity. It is not an organized religion or connected with specific Christian denominations, but it is practiced independently by individuals and individual congregations. So the kids were occasionally attending an establishment that preached these ideas and tied white nationalism and medieval anti-Semitism together. Also, the family was neighbors and friends with Chevy Kehoe and his brother Shane. Chevy Kehoe is a known white supremacist and convicted murderer who was given 3 consecutive life sentences for the kidnapping, torture, rape, and murder of William Muller and his family. So just a terrible person overall. Early on, Keyes began displaying some of the classic signs of a killer that we've all heard about. A tendency of aggression, committing smaller crimes such as burglary and arson, and animal abuse. It was said that Keyes would often have a pistol on him, even as a young child. At the age of 14, his grandfather gave him a .38 caliber revolver, which he then outfitted with his first homemade silencer. He and a friend were known to break into local houses and burglarize them. Then Keyes began killing pet animals. All bad signs. While in custody, Keyes himself said, quote, "I've known since I was 14 that there were things that that I thought were normal and that were okay that nobody else seemed to think were normal and okay.
By 1995, at the age of 17, Keyes had been working for a construction company. And then in the late 90s, the Keyes family moved to Smyrna?
That's actually very hard to Smyrna. Say. I'm not quite sure. Sorry, if anyone's from Maine, let us know.
The following pronunciation is brought to you by PronounceNames.com.
Smyrna.
Smyrna, yo.
Smyrna, Maine. So they moved to Smyrna, Maine, where they got involved in what other business than the maple syrup business.
Okay, well,
classic New England, right? New England must have had some kind of effect on Keyes because he also decided to officially reject his parents' faith and declared himself an atheist. He and his father thus cut ties, and he was subsequently kicked out of the family home. 1998, Keyes went to New Jersey and enlisted in the U.S. Army. He was stationed at Fort Lewis near Tacoma, Washington, and Fort Hood in Killeen, Texas, and was trained in Sinai, Egypt. It's pretty cool. In 2001, he received a DUI charge in Washington, followed by a state charge for driving with a suspended license, and later that year was honorably discharged from the Army in July 2001. Okay, real quick. So if anyone's out there, I just wanted to let them know that I received an official letter from the RMV of Massachusetts in April 2020 that did say, and this is reading it exactly from the letter, that due to the pandemic, the Mass RMV has taken measures to reduce customer visits in our service centers. All Massachusetts IDs that expire in June, July, or August of 2020 have been extended, and it will be updated in the database.
For anyone that's confused, this has nothing to do with the story. This is a side rant.
This is a very side rant.
Also, yes. PSA, I guess.
Yes, PSA, kind of. Nowhere on this sheet does it say, one, how long your license has been extended for, and two, when your license expires. So my birthday is in one of those months, and I just kept driving.
You're trying to be secretive.
Well, I mean, you can probably guess anywhere. But anyway, long story short, I got pulled over, and I couldn't leave because I was driving without a license illegally. And of course, I didn't have the paper from the RMV in my glove box, so I had no proof at the time, and it doesn't say anything on their website. Very lucky I managed to get a next day appointment at the RMV and was incredibly grateful because of just, you know, COVID-19 and the RMV in general is not great, but I'm okay now. And I brought the paper with me and I asked them, I said, when did my license expire? And the answer they gave me was not concrete or definite. They said sometime in September. They didn't even know the official date there. They didn't even know. So apologies for the brief intermission, but if you think your license was extended, just go and call them. They'll hate it, but you can call them right up on your local RMV website, or you can just renew and get the real ID. But listen, it was a headache and a half. I had to call Katie. She had to get my car.
We don't need
up.
To jump into it.
It was quite that. We said we had no updates, but that's actually an update from our lives. So that's it. Now
that's
moving.
That's true. But however, Israel Keyes was not in a pandemic when he was driving with a suspended license. So he doesn't really have the same.
That's true. So it's like a PSA slash story time, but now we'll move back to the story.
Oh, Lord.
Keyes then moved to Nea Bay, Washington, where he established a village market for the nearby Maka tribe. He began dating an unknown woman whom he had a daughter with and lived on the Maka reservation with the mother of his daughter for about 6 years, but later would separate with that woman who took their daughter with her. In 2006, he started running marathons, and he also began dating someone else. Keyes then shifted to Anchorage with his daughter, along with his new girlfriend in 2007. And in that same year, he opened his business, his own business, called Keyes Construction. Now, throughout this whole timeline we've been presenting, Keyes was traveling a lot for unknown reasons that they know of, you know, that the family knows of. But now we know he was actually committing multiple murders while he was traveling. We'll get into those details, but it just goes to show you how seemingly, quote, normal person could be living a completely secret life. And this is not like the first time we've presented these examples to you. For instance, in the public eye, Keyes worked his construction business and was a good boyfriend to his nurse practitioner girlfriend and was a great father to his daughter. There's actually a quote from CBS News when one of his coworkers came forward and said he was responsible father to his daughter. And this is perhaps one of the reasons why nobody could really believe that Keyes was leading this double life. His former coworker said, quote, he would come into work and brag about his daughter. He was a loving dad, a doting father, end quote.
Okay, so a little bit of a jump here. We're going to 2012. In February of 2012, an 18-year-old named Samantha Koenig was killed. Her boyfriend received a text that there was a ransom note in Connors Bog Park in Anchorage, Alaska. That ransom note was found and was later recovered by Anchorage police, and it included a Polaroid photo of Samantha in which she still looked alive, a photo of Keyes' arm holding the Anchorage Daily News from February 13th, 2012, and a note that demanded $30,000. Her family, seeing the photo of her, they were hoping she was still alive, so they abided by the note, and they were able to deposit the $30,000 into her, Samantha's, account. From what I've heard, they actually, the family themselves didn't have that much money, but I think there was like a communal
fund.
Yeah, so I think the community actually ended up getting the $30,000 to put into her, Samantha's, account, which was what was requested in the note. The next month, Alaskan authorities and the FBI were alerted about withdrawals being made from Samantha's bank account. The withdrawals were being made by one Israel Keyes. They alerted authorities to be on the lookout for a 2012 Ford Focus, which was the rental car that Keyes was using at the time. On March 13th, Texas Highway Patrol Corporal Brian Henry noticed Keyes' car. That's kind of a play on words. Car keys, Keyes' car. Anyway, they noticed Keyes' car and followed in onto Highway 59 in Texas. Keyes was pulled over and authorities found Samantha's debit card and phone, a ski mask, a gun, cash, and highlighted maps of California, Arizona, and New Mexico. So I read one place, and I'm not sure if this is true, but I read one place that Keyes had this 2012 Ford Focus, and the cops knew to look for this car. And during this time, Keyes actually returned that rental car and got another rental car, but he got the exact same rental car, the 2012 Ford Focus. And so they were still able to find him because he got the same exact car, which is jokes on you, buddy.
Interesting.
Yes. And then I think the cops found him on the highway and wanted to pull him over, but needed an excuse. But then he ended up speeding, I guess, so they were able to pull him over for that. So he's in custody. On March 26, 2012, Keyes, who is now back in Anchorage, Alaska, confessed to murdering Samantha. Her body would later be discovered on April 1st. While in custody, investigators struck a deal with Keyes that if they could find the bodies of any potential prior victims, then in exchange, they would not tell the media any details that Keyes did not want to make public. So Keyes agreed. And that was when the authorities realized the full extent of Keyes' killings, or started to realize. According to Keyes, his first planned attack took place in Oregon in 1997 or 1998, when he abducted and raped a teenage girl before letting her leave. And then in 2009, Keyes decided to rob a bank after allegedly abducting and murdering a man. This is all alleged by him. He robbed the community bank in Tupper Lake, New York, with a .40 caliber Smith & Wesson semi-automatic pistol. After that, Keyes fled to Essex, Vermont, where he buried a toolbox down a path in the Woodside Natural Area. The toolbox contained desiccant, which is a hydroscopic substance used as a drying agent, which are basically those little white bead packets in shoeboxes or purses that you've seen. The box also contained the pistol he used to rob the bank, and then another pistol. We're going to talk a little bit more about this kind of kit later, because this wouldn't be his first kit that he made. And then in 2011, Keyes constructed a homemade silencer for his Ruger Charger pistol and wanted to try it out. So Keyes flew to Indiana, and then from there drove to New York, and then from there drove back to Essex, Vermont to recover the toolbox he had buried 2 years prior. That's when he got the idea to test the silencer by killing a victim totally at random, supposedly, and then go on a bank robbing spree. At first, Keyes planned to hide in the woods and choose an oncoming motorist to target at random. But then I guess he didn't like that idea anymore, so then he decided to set his sights on a house. Late in the night on July 8th, 2011, Keyes was walking around a suburban neighborhood in Essex. He landed on 8 Colbert Street, the home of Bill and Lorraine Currier. Keyes inspected the house and determined which room the couple was sleeping in. We've heard reports that he looked for houses where there were no children, there were no dogs, which makes sense, and he liked when they had a connecting garage. Apparently, this house fit his requirements. So when he got to the house, he cut the phone line, he broke inside, and then he managed to subdue the couple, the couriers, by tying them up. He took Lorraine's Smith & Wesson revolver that he saw at the site. He was able to then take the couple that he had tied up to an abandoned farmhouse in Essex. Lorraine, at one point, had tried to escape, but sadly was recaptured by Keyes. And then at another point, Bill also tried to escape, but Keyes was able to stop him. But he was in a fit of rage at that point, basically over his inability to completely control the situation. So in his fit of rage, Keyes fatally shot Bill with a gun. Keyes then sexually assaulted Lorraine, strangled her, not fatally at first, and then dragged her into the basement of this farmhouse, where he then strangled Lorraine to death. Keyes buried both of the couriers' bodies in debris and left them in the abandoned basement. And from what I've read, that abandoned farmhouse was later caught on fire, and so their remains were never recovered.
His plan was to then go on a bank robbing spree, but this plan failed when the courier's car that he had taken started experiencing some serious mechanical issues. So he abandoned that and then went to the White National Monument Forest in New Hampshire to dispose of the items he stole from the couriers in a fire. Then he drove all the way back to New York to dispose of his tools and the courier's gun. Finally, he returned home to Anchorage. It's a lot of miles.
Yeah.
Clearly, Keyes liked to use the element of distance. He liked to commit his crimes and dispose of his evidence over a large radius. This made it very difficult for authorities to track him down. It would be February of 2012 when Keyes would kill again. In Anchorage, he set his sights on 18-year-old barista Samantha Koenig. On the evening of February 1st, Keyes went to her roadside espresso stand, put a gun to her head, and demanded money. She obliged, but that's not all that Keyes wanted. Keyes tied Samantha up and dragged her outside into his truck before driving her back to his house. The next day, Keyes went to Samantha's house, broke into her boyfriend's truck where he found a debit card that was a shared debit card between Samantha and her boyfriend, and he tested it out to make sure it worked, and it did. He then returned home and murdered Samantha. Her body was left in a shed on his property.
I just want to, there's a couple things that we heard, didn't have it in here, but I guess when Keyes got Samantha and kidnapped her from that little roadside espresso thing, it kind of looks like a food truck, but it's for coffee. Apparently, he texted Samantha's boss and then also Samantha's boyfriend and told them that he was acting like he was her. And he said something along the lines of, I had a tough day at work. I'm going on a vacation or I'm taking the weekend off or something. I guess to kind of take them off his trail for a little while. But he did that. And then also, so when he brought her back to his house, left her there, and then went to, he knew that her debit card was in her truck because she had told him. It's a truck, I don't know if it's her truck or her boyfriend's truck or they share it, whatever, but they share the debit card. So he had gone to her house, to her truck, to get the debit card. And I guess while he was there breaking into the truck, Samantha's boyfriend actually saw him breaking a truck and was like, oh, what are you doing? And went to call the police. But by the time he walked back outside, Keyes was gone. So her boyfriend knew that something was going on and that this something wasn't right here.
It just so happened Keyes had a cruise scheduled for that next day. So the morning after killing Samantha, he got up, left for New Orleans, where he was supposed to get on the cruise. And I guess he did get on the cruise.
Yeah, I mean, he went on this cruise. It was like a 2-week Caribbean cruise that he boarded the day after he murdered.
He didn't even take Samantha. His family?
I don't know who he went on the cruise with. I couldn't find that. Maybe he went solo. I don't know. But he went on like a full 2-week all-inclusive, maybe not all-inclusive, cruise to the Caribbean.
So they have stops on those cruises. I wonder if it was a relaxing cruise or if it was, like, a cruise where he killed more people.
I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it's just another, like, arc in his travels of another point that he's been
to. He definitely dropped something off in the ocean.
I mean, a cruise, if you're gonna kill someone and dispose of them, that's the place to do it.
Yeah, they travel.
Maybe. I don't know for sure.
So when he returned back from the cruise, Keyes decided to head to an area just west of Dallas, Texas. There, he robbed a house before burning it down. He then drove to the nearby town, Azle, where he robbed the National Bank of Texas. He managed to get away with the heist and buried that money around the Post Oak Cemetery in Glen Rose. Then he returned back to Anchorage, and it is at this point that we mentioned earlier that he puts together the ransom for Samantha by staging her body to make her look alive to give her family hope. To note, this is about 2 weeks after he killed Samantha, and you would think it'd be very difficult to make a body that's been decomposing for 2 weeks make it look alive, but given that the body was in a shed in Anchorage, the cold temperatures kept the body frozen, and this definitely helped. Keyes arranged and groomed the body to make it seem like she was still alive, and he sewed her eyes open, sat her up, and then took the realistic photo. Keyes then proceeded to dismember Samantha's body and dispose of her remains in the frozen Matanuska Lake. This is when Keyes began to use Samantha's debit card, which eventually leads to his arrest. So while in custody, Keyes said that he killed, quote, less than a dozen. Authorities believe that the total number of victims is 11. However, we still only know of the three victims, Samantha Koenig and the couriers. Keyes did claim he took at least five other lives, but never named these victims. According to Keyes, he killed four people in Washington state, a couple sometime between 2001 and 2005, and two victims in 2005 and 2006. He also said he murdered someone on the East Coast in 2009 and left the body in New York. The FBI later said they are, quote, relatively confident that this victim was Deborah Fieldman, a New Jersey resident who went missing in April 2009. Keyes would occasionally give little crumbs of clues about other murders he'd committed around the country, but he never gave any names.
When Keyes was in custody, he acted kind of peculiar, I guess you could say. He was very calm, very confident, not afraid of what was going to happen to him now that he was caught. He was confessing to Samantha's murder after all, so he wasn't really acting nervous, but he was frustrated. Frustrated at how long everything in the justice system took, specifically how long it would take for him to be executed. He did not want to rot behind bars. At one point, Keyes said, quote, "The reason I'm doing this is that I know, I always knew that I was playing for keeps, and I knew that this was inevitable. What's going to happen is going to happen. I can accept that, and I am ready for it. I'm more than ready for it. My issue is how long it's taking and how long it could take if we don't figure out a way to expedite things." Okay, buddy, expedite things. Part of the bargain he made with investigators was that he would plead guilty as long as he was executed and the trial took less than a year. It was somewhat of a game to Keyes to see how little information he could give to get the things that he wanted in return. Details of the murder of the couriers was one of the nuggets of info that Keyes gave authorities as part of their deal. But this is something that he did not want the media knowing about. He made that pretty clear. I mean, it's interesting how we hear a lot about murderers who want their story to be told, right? They want their name in the media. They want to gawk over their own fame while they're watching the news reports. But Keyes wasn't really like that. I don't know. He wasn't in it for the fame, apparently. He also did have a mother and a daughter that he probably wanted to shield from his terrible crimes. While in custody, Keyes said, quote, "I want my kid to have a chance to grow up. You know, she's in a safe place now. She's not going to see any of this. I want her to have a chance to grow up and not have all of this hanging over her head," end quote. During one of the interviews, he basically said that he just didn't want his daughter to grow up, Google his name, and then find out that he raped women and killed multiple people. But I feel like he probably just should have thought about that before he committed the crimes. That's pretty pretentious. But so there's basically all of his interviews were videotaped and they're all accessible. They're all online. You can YouTube them. there's a lot, like, there's a lot of footage of him talking to interviewers at this time. I watched, like, a few minutes, but honestly, it's just, you don't want to watch them. They're so boring. They're very anticlimactic, I guess you could say. Like, he just, they ask him questions and he just dances around subjects. He avoids a lot of subjects. He doesn't give them straight answers. Like, it's just, he just talks and talks in circles. And, like, all this, like, superfluous stuff that they don't care about. It's clear that he doesn't want to give any detail, really, which is what I mean when he says he doesn't really want the fame. Like, he doesn't want people to know about the details of things. He was basically just giving up some information, like the couriers, in order to get executed, really. He just didn't want to rot in jail. He was also, like, very arrogant. He wanted to control the situation at all points. He kept saying that he would abide by the rules if the cops did. He knew they weren't on the same team. There was an agreement between them, and as long as the cops stick to their agreement, he would stick to his, blah, 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 blah. He was very, he thought he was the shit, basically. But, like, these videos are boring. Don't watch them. And it just makes you mad. It made me mad. So I stopped watching them. But you can watch them if you want to. So then on July 20th of that year, in 2012, a news outlet broke the story on Keyes' connection to the murder of the couriers in Vermont. So at this point, it was just information that he had told authorities. No one else knew. It was part of the agreement that the media wouldn't find out. I don't know how the cops could actually control that completely, but a news outlet did break that story. So that set Keyes off. And he didn't speak to investigators again for 2 months after that. And then on the night of December 1st, 2012, Keyes wrote a 2-page suicide note before slashing his own wrists with a razor and then strangling himself with a bedsheet. Keyes had a history of violent uproars while in custody, so because of that, he was under strict supervision. Think increased security measures, full restraints, officer escorts at all times, restrictions on razor and pencil possessions, and daily searches. But somehow, someone made a mistake, and a razor had been given to Keyes while he was in jail. So that's how he killed himself. And then his body was found the next morning. So we mentioned this 2-page suicide note that Keyes wrote and then left for authorities to find, along with his body. So the suicide note was given to authorities, obviously. It was 2 pages front and back. It was pretty long. It was written on, like, a yellow legal pad that we've all seen. It was smeared in blood. It was really messy. It was hard to read. Like, I've seen pictures of the original, but police had to transcribe it, basically, so that they could read this. And whenever a killer leaves a note, I think it's pretty closely read and looked at, because you want to know if this killer is giving hint, especially with Israel Keyes. I mean, he supposedly killed at least 7 more people, and they don't know who these people are or where they were killed or buried. And so I think they had to read through this letter pretty thoroughly to see if there were any clues about anything. But they concluded that there really isn't much to see here. And I read through it, and there really isn't. I mean, it's just really like a poem, like a bad poem, like a poem that you would write in, like, 5th grade if you were very mentally unstable. I mean, it's gross. I have heard that maybe there are some kind of speculations as to local places that are in here, that if somebody from that town read it, maybe they'd recognize it. I don't know. It doesn't really seem like it to me. I mean, it's just a gross poem this guy wrote about killing someone and liking the feeling. And he also has a lot of language in here about the typical American, like, life, and how he loathes people that just wake up in the morning, drive to their job, don't care about anything, watch the news, like, act like they don't care about anything that's going on. I don't know. It's very, very pretentious. I'll read a few lines just to show you guys what I mean, but it's probably not worth your time to read the whole thing. So I'll just read the first couple lines, I guess. Where will you go, you clever little worm, if you bleed your host dry? Back in your ride, the night is still young. Streetlights push back the black I neat rose. Off to the right, a graveyard appears. Lines of stones, bodies molder below. Turn away quick, bob your head to the seat. As straight through that stop sign you roll, loaded truck with lights off slams into you broadside, your flesh mashed as metal explodes. You may have been free, you loved living your life, fate had its own scheme, crushed like a bug, you still die. Now, soon, you'll join those ranks of dead, or your ashes the wind will soon blow. Family and friends will shed a few tears, pretend it's off to heaven you go, but the reality is you were just bones and meat, and with your brain died also your soul. So it just gets worse from there. Basically, it's not even anything about him or his life or how he feels. It's just like a poem about killing someone. And that was the suicide note that he left.
So from ABC, they interviewed Dr. Stephen Montgomery, a forensic psychiatrist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, who said that his writings in the letter show intelligence, clear understanding what Keyes knows his behavior was wrong. He said he's writing this so people find it, talk about it, and magnify his self-worth, which is interesting because that's what he said he didn't want in his interviews.
Yeah, I feel like he tries, and I think this comes off, like he tries very hard to sound like an intelligent, artistic person who's like doing all of this descriptive writing in a poem. And it's not so much, I mean, it's not so much that he wants recognition for the murders, but it feels like he wants to be known as very smart and like some kind of genius in his own right, I guess. Like it comes off like that.
Maybe. So he ends the writing with these lines. I'm just gonna read the last line. Okay, talk is over, words are placid and weak. Back it with action or it all comes off cheap. Watch close while I work now, feel the electric shock of my touch. Open your trembling flower or your petals I'll crush.
I mean, I'm puking. That's
the disgusting. The whole letter is kind of different variations of that.
Yeah, basically. And it's weird that he also like talks about like his hatred for like get in your big car so you can get to work fast on roads made of dinosaur bones, punch in on the clock and sit on your ass playing stupid ass games on your phone. Paper on the wall says you got the smarts, the test that you took told you so, but you would still crawl like the vermin you are. I mean, he's basically like, what, so you have a college degree and a job, you think you're smart? No, I am. It's like, okay.
Interestingly enough, his psychological evaluation did reveal that his intelligence bordered from average to high and that he did not have any mental health issues. He was a completely functional person living in society with a family. We talked about this before, and many people, I'm sure, have picked this up from other true crime shows that we watched. But a key in most investigations is figuring out the perp's victim profile. A pattern in the victims can often help build a psychological profile of the suspect, aiding in the search. But with Keyes, there wasn't really a pattern in the victims that he chose. And that's mainly because Keyes did not go after his victims. There's no evidence that he pre-planned to kill his specific victims. Instead, Keyes had victims of opportunity. He was often described as a spider building his web and waiting for his victims to fly directly into it. He talked about this once in an interview saying, quote, not as much to choose from in a manner of speaking, but there's also no witness, really. There's no one else around, end quote. Because he went after his victims in the moment, he was able to just drive to a random town and choose a victim at random. His travels across the country were vast and almost constant and created a very confusing roadmap for investigators to try and follow. When he killed the couriers in Vermont, that trip had consisted of a flight to Chicago and then renting a car and driving all the way up to Vermont. In fact, Keyes had rented many cars during his travels, and that is something that the investigators were able to use to hack his travels. But Keyes would often use cash and take the battery out of his cell phone to make it even harder to track him. Maureen Callahan is the author of the 2019 book, American Predator. And in that book, Maureen notes that Keyes had been fitted with a gastric band and had visited a plastic surgery clinic while in Mexico on one of his trips. She speculated that perhaps the gastric band could mean he wouldn't get hungry as often, which could have aided him in his travels. And he may have changed his fingerprints or removed body hair to lessen the chances of leaving evidence behind. So, Does this make him a genius killing mastermind? No. Anyone could tell you it would be harder to track you down if you were constantly driving across the country. It seems like he just had a lot of time on his hands, and he made very basic mistakes by using Samantha's debit card to take money out of her account, because that's very trackable. Yes, he wore a disguise when he would take money out of an ATM, so you couldn't really tell it was him on the video, but they were still able to track his car and track him down in that way. So Keyes was probably just really desperate for money at that point and didn't think through his every move. But he was very careful, very sick man who spent a lot of time planning his moves by covering his tracks. And he liked to do that with the boxes and evidence that he planted around. Special Agent Jolene Godin with FBI Anchorage Division had this to say about it. Quote, although he chose many of his victims randomly, a tremendous amount of planning went into these crimes. Keyes enjoyed what he did, and he had no remorse at all. He told us if he hadn't been caught, he would have continued kidnapping and murdering people, end quote. The FBI has described Keyes as one of the most meticulous serial killers in American history.
Given that Keyes killed himself before investigators were able to get more info out of him, there are almost certainly a number of victims that are still unidentified. FBI agents they're still working on the case. They're currently working with law enforcement around the country to try to link Keyes to open homicide cases, which is difficult considering you can't narrow it down to one location at one time. I mean, he is across the country, but they are trying to do it. Just earlier this year, in May of 2020, CBS's show 48 Hours did a special on Keyes, where they interviewed FBI agents in Anchorage, Alaska. The FBI agents promised to reveal to CBS important details never before made public, and they delivered. FBI Special Agents Jolene Godin and Catherine Nelson revealed to the show's producers a series of sheets of papers. Each sheet had a hand-painted image of a human skull drawn in the blood of Keyes himself. In total, there were 11 skull paintings, if you can call them that, that were found under his bed in his jail cell when he was in jail. You can look up a picture of these sheets. You can Google it. There's actually 12 sheets of paper, 11 skulls, and I think the 12th one had a...
Satan?
Yeah. The 12th one, I think, had like a Satan symbol on it of the devil star with the devil... thing.
Yeah, with like a ram in the middle.
Yes. Yeah. And then one of the skulls said, "We are one," I think.
Looks like one. Again, it's not with a paintbrush or anything.
No, so. It's with his finger that he's dipping in his own blood. The 48 Hours team was also the first to be shown one of Keyes' real life, quote, killing kits or cash. They call them killing. I think he called them caches, killing caches. But basically, these were the kits that he would bury across the country. I've read that they've found four of them. I've read that they've only found two or three, so I'm not sure. But he would put all of his equipment in these kits and bury... I don't know if he buried them or just put them in random spots to hide so that he could come back later and get them. The kit that was shown on the show in 48 hours, included a handgun, a homemade silencer, ammunition, and zip ties. So this was kind of the basic gathering of things that he would put in these boxes. Like we said, they also have the drying agent in some of them. So these killing kits were just another way for Keyes to be able to... I mean, it's another pre-thought-out thing, right? And that does take a lot of pre-planning to put these kits together, know where you're going to put them, and then remember... somehow that exact location to be able to come back in the future and get them. It is a good way to, you know, if you're going to be driving and you do get pulled over by police, you probably don't want the gun that you're going to use to kill someone in your car with you, along with other things like silencers and whatever. Not to mention, he also took flights all over the place too. I mean, he flew to places and then drove and then flew again and then drove again. So you couldn't get on the plane with the guns, obviously, so he would just have to pre-plant them and come back to them later. So although we only know of three or four of these, there probably is more. I mean, we can't say for sure, but I would not be surprised.
Neither would I.
So they could be, and he would hide them in like a national park or a forest or something where really you wouldn't find it unless you're, I don't know, a hiker or something. So they won't be easy to find, but there are likely more out there. It's been 7.5 years since Keyes died. The FBI hopes that the latest 48-hour special will help drum up some kind of interest in the case and encourage people to come forward. FBI Special Agent Julian Godin said, quote, "All the victims that we don't have identified. That's what this case is all about." Godin, along with Special Agent Catherine Nelson, admit that this will not be an easy case to solve, but they do remain resolute that they will never give up trying. That being said, since this is ongoing, if you have any information that may be of any interest to authorities, please call the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI, or you can report tips online at fbi.gov/tips/. You know. Also, there's a map and a timeline of Israel Keyes' known travels and activity from 1997 all the way up to 2012, which is really helpful. And also, it's pretty interesting. It's all over the map. So it's helpful if you're trying to figure out where he was at a certain time to know if you might have any info. So go take a look at that if you're interested. Just Google it. I took a look at it to see how active Keyes would have been around that time in New England area. And New England, I mean, he wasn't really that active there. It wasn't his favorite spots. His favorite spots seemed to be Washington and California, obviously, along with Alaska. But besides his trip to Essex, during which he murdered Bill and Lorraine Currier, his timeline does show him making multiple trips to Manchester, New Hampshire, as well as Boston. It's interesting. Like, it tells you when he was there, and they know by either flight records or rental car records, basically, or all of them. So it'll say, like, what day he flew in, what day he rented a car, what day he left. It's very comprehensive. Also, if you guys want any more information about this case or about his victims, the Murder Squad with Billy Jensen and Paul Hills, which I'm such a stan of. I love that podcast. Shout out. Not that they'll ever listen to this. No, so they, episode 11 of their podcast, they covered Israel Keyes, and it's really good because I like this podcast because they're like ex-investigators, so they have a lot of really good insights into, I guess, their own experience and how that relates to investigation, and they give a lot of like their opinions on what that meant for him as a person, why he was traveling so much, where his other victims could be, stuff like that. It is very interesting. So, not to give so much airtime to another podcast besides ours, but seeing as you listen to this one already, I guess you can check it out. And that's it. That's the end of the story for now. Hopefully at some point we can drum up a little more evidence in this case to figure out who the other victims were. Okay, so we'll post some photos on Instagram because there's a lot of the stuff we mentioned, there's photos of.
Yep.
The suicide note, the drawings of the skulls and blood.
Yep. His bags that he put around.
His kit, his murder kits. I'm not sure if there's a photo of the ransom note.
There is.
There might be. If yes. There is, we'll post that. There might have been a couple other things, but we'll post them all on Instagram. Go take a look. Yeah. Any insights you have, let someone know. But don't waste your time watching the videos of him. They're terrible. But besides that, to go look at those photos, you do have to be following us. So our Instagram is Killer Babes Podcast.
As is our Facebook and our email at gmail.com.
Yes.
And Twitter is almost it, but it got cut off. So it's Killer Babe Pod.
Yes. Go check it out, guys. And then, like we said, every time, let us know if there's anything you want us to cover. Let us know if you know anything about this case that we missed, of course. All right. Well, that rounds out episode 42. We will see you next week.
Yeah. On Tuesday or Wednesday.
I don't know yet.
We'll see you next week.
We'll see you sometime.
Bye.